I just got to ask, can you do 10 one-arm pull-ups? And if you can you do it on an edge?
I think I've done 5 on the Peacemaker middle edge, but I've done 10 on a, bar with both hands. And that was pretty recent. That was actually my, like, randomly I decided, like, I wanted to leave the gym tired one of the days leading up to training for the Olympics. I was like, I'm going to do something right before I leave to figure out, like, or just to, like, make sure that I'm still strong. And I grabbed a bar in the TC and I did 10 one arms for the first time. And then I came down and I was like, man, I wonder if I could do it on my non-dominant side. And I cranked out 10 on the other side as well. And I was like, well, I'm still strong and now I'm a little tired leaving the gym.
Hey, welcome to the Test Piece Podcast. This podcast is about all things high-level climbing. My name's Joshua Horsley. I've been climbing for 25 years, and I love staying at the cutting edge of climbing.
Hi, my name is Timothy Kang. I'm a pro climber, a coach, and a route setter, and climbing is my life.
We started the podcast to explore and articulate what it takes to climb at a high level, what it takes to go from good to great. Okay, let's start the podcast. All right, Zach Gala, welcome to the Test Piece Podcast. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Good, good. I like when we hopped on, you were like packing because you are leaving for Red Rocks this morning. And I was just thinking that, you know, life is good when you start Monday morning off by talking about climbing and then you're about to hop in the car and go to one of the best areas in the country for bouldering. So yeah, man, thanks for squeezing this in.
Yeah, for sure. I'm excited for it.
Yeah, I got to ask, do you have anything specific on your tick list for Red Rocks? Just is it just for fun or anything catch your eye?
Definitely. I've put a few days into Sleepwalker over the past like 2 seasons. I think maybe only 4 or so sessions total. And so that one's definitely like on my list. But mostly the trip is just to kind of like reset. I've been really locked into trying this boulder in Little Cottonwood Canyon that Sean Bailey recently put up. And it's been a quite annoying process trying that one, kind of like feet crumbling and changing my beta. And I've just been, it's kind of a hard one to try. So I'm just excited. I needed to like go somewhere else and climb on a different boulder to get like a mental reset before I come back and reinvest some time into that thing. So that's kind of the main goal of the trip, is to just like refresh the brain, get psyched on climbing on other stuff. And then hopefully that brings the fire back for my, my project just around town.
Dude, that thing looks really good. That's in Little Cottonwood Canyon, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. You posted some reels or some stories of you trying it. And it looked cold for one thing, man. And it also looks very, very different from something like Sleepwalker or just Red Rocks in general. So I wonder, any thoughts about how that translates, like doing that kind of techie granite climbing? And then, I mean, Red Rocks isn't crazy thuggy, but I mean, it's sandstone. It's different. Sleepwalker is different than that.
Very different. Yeah. The thing with this new boulder is when everything flows really well on it, it's something that's like really enjoyable to climb on. But a lot of the things that are really hard about it are finicky. You know, you're standing on these like tiny little granite dime edges. So like a lot of times you'll fall with both your hands on the wall and your feet just blow out and you land on the pads. But and so it kind of is a different process than something like Sleepwalker, where you're usually able to like really pinpoint what you did wrong on Sleepwalker, since it's so much more straightforward. The holds are bigger. It's a lot more like power and like body climbing than the project up here. So it's kind of hard to transition back and forth, but staying really locked in on that technical style and trying it days in a row, it's like you will make progress for a point. But I think with something like that, it's nice to have like a reset and come back to it. You kind of like get this new confidence taking a break and coming back, that can be really good for something that's more subtle like that.
Okay. I'm totally getting ahead of myself. I haven't even done a proper intro for you, but I just can't help it. when we last were chatting, you were just saying how you loved sinking your, or like you can say, like getting your fingers behind holds, like really being powerful and like crushing boulders. And it's interesting to me that you're getting sucked into this thing in LCC that's very super technical. I mean, it doesn't look crazy steep. Like how'd you get so sucked into it when it sounds like not exactly like what you love in climbing?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting one, because the crux, it boils down to like a very powerful move on these like flat edges. But a lot of the difficulty is kind of built from the feet being really bad because it's on not as steep of a wall. But it really climbs in a way that suits my style pretty well. Yeah, the wall is just really aesthetic, and I just knew when I first saw the boulder that it was something that I wanted to climb, and it's kind of one of those long standing, until Sean did it recently, it was one of those long standing just notorious LCC projects that needed to get climbed. And it's one of those things when you pull up and look at it, you're like, wow, like there is just only the perfect amount of stuff to make this thing go. If one foot was gone or one hand was a little worse, like this thing would totally not be possible. And I think something that's right on that line is like the main thing that I'm looking for when I'm like picking out projects. Is I like when something doesn't have very many options. The holds are the holds, and like this is what you have to do. And that boulder kind of checks the boxes for me to get me psyched. So even though it's not directly in my style, it's a cool, unique challenge, and I like to keep it diverse. So.
Yeah. I mean, it looks gorgeous, and it's interesting how granite can sometimes be really powerful with those flat edges. And then that those bad feet, it's like technical in the sense of extreme body tension and really connecting with that foot. And yes, it's technical and tiny, but I wonder if you said it's still somewhat in your wheelhouse. Maybe it's not your exact style, but there's something about that like burly granite all over tension that I dig it too. So anyways, all right, man. We'll probably get into it later. I'm supposed to give you your intro. I'm not the biggest fan of these intros where we list off a bunch of accomplishments. It's like clearly even just what we were talking about is the cutting edge of bouldering right now. Like those climbs you're talking about are literally the cutting edge. So you are a V16 boulderer. You've gotten first at a lot of competitions. You've been to the World Cups. You've battled for trying to get your spot in the Olympics and come achingly close a handful of times. But I guess, Zach, I love watching you climb. One of the reasons I'm psyched to chat with you, because you really seem like one of the physically best climbers in the game right now. When I say physically best, I mean you're strong, man. You're really strong. And, you know, on the podcast, we talk a lot about technique. We talk a lot about the mental game. And of course, technique, the mental side of things are all intricately linked to what we do. But I love raw freaking power also. And I would say you have that in spades. And it sounds like you enjoy deploying that power too. That's my intro for you, is you've done a lot of great stuff, but you're extremely powerful, and that's why I'm so psyched to have you on today. Welcome to the pod, man. Psyched to chat with you and get your take on all these things, high level climbing.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Josh. I'm excited to talk about it too.
So again, I'm going to start atypically with you, because usually we did just dive into actual climbing, but I wanted to go back to kind of some of your formative years in climbing. And I think the thing that stuck out to me and why I want to, you know, go back to when you were a bit younger is that it sounded like as you were growing up in the South, which you can share more about, you were equally psyched on competition climbing and outdoor climbing. And I think that's somewhat rare, because either the gym scene is super strong and, you know, it's because there's boulders too far away and people get really sucked down that rabbit hole of competition climbing. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Or, you know, people fall in love with nature and that pursuit and they kind of head that way. And they're both different. But you kind of shared that you loved them both. And so I thought that would be a good place to start, because it really will connect into what we're talking about today.
Yeah, for sure. I am very lucky with my introduction to climbing. I grew up in Suwanee, Georgia, which is a suburb that's like 30 minutes north of Atlanta. And there's just one little gym that happens to be in town up there called Adrenaline Climbing. And it's kind of like old plaster walls, some like natural rock features around and stuff. And when I was first climbing there, especially, it was very like holds on the wall, straightforward climbing. The gym was always, it was set up to V7 and basically, and has always kind of stayed that way. So as I got stronger and stronger at climbing, all the setters at the gym were like, Zach climbs V7, you know, or like, and so they would make sure that like all of the, even when I was climbing V13 and stuff outside, the V7s were like my projects at the gym. So anyways, stiff, typical Southern gym, and the owners were really great. You know, they, I think it was a good place to grow up because it had like all these fun little nooks and crannies to climb into when I was younger and keep me intrigued. There was like a top out boulder that you could hang out on. There was another place that you could top out and take a slide down. So there was all this stuff to like keep me intrigued and entertained when I was little, but then still, a lot of climbing to progress through, at that gym as well. And the owners were, you know, really big in the developing scene climbing in Chattanooga, but also like understood the importance of competitions and that the kids on the team were going to be psyched to compete. So, they definitely like introduced like a really good balance, loading all the kids up in the van and taking us up to Chattanooga for weekend trips or like a week long summer camping trip. So they were always like sharing their love for climbing and all the different facets and kind of introducing, every opportunity and every, angle of the sport that you could decide to take. So I'm really grateful for that upbringing at Adrenaline.
I got to point out that it's a very cool name to say Adrenaline Climbing. Like I'm assuming it's in this small, it's a small gym in a small town, and it doesn't sound like it's named like this normal, I don't know, like rock climbing for kids or something. It's just, it's Adrenaline Climbing. Like that's a very intense name.
Yeah.
But it's so awesome way to start out as a youth. And I love that they embrace both sides of it. I actually, when you said those trips in a van to places, it brought me back. I was on a climbing team a long time ago and hopping in the van with your friends. It's just, I mean, it's some of the best memories ever. And so I'm curious though, it sounded like eventually you even outgrew V7 and you had to move to a bigger team. And that sounded like a big inflection point for you too.
Yeah, definitely. I always had this, I really appreciated everybody that was at Adrenaline and my core group of friends that stuck around and stayed on the team. But I think, I'm not exactly sure the year that Stone Summit opened, but there was a few years where I stayed on the Adrenaline team and kind of finished out my youth A with them. And then as I got older and inevitably got my driver's license, then it made a lot more sense. Since I was like a lot deeper in the competition scene, that I really needed to like expand and kind of get my hands on some more competition style resources and stuff. And having Stone Summit 30 minutes away was the perfect opportunity and place to do that. And having a coach like Claudio that had a lot of knowledge in that side of the competition field is really what I needed to progress at that point in my career. So yeah, moved over to Stone Summit once I was able to drive because my parents didn't want to drive 30 minutes and drop me off and drive back, you know? So, once I was able to drive myself down there, I started going and training with them. And then that definitely like opened up a whole new door and, progressed my competition skills like really fast. So.
Yeah. That's quite a program they've got down there. I'm kind of curious,
for sure,
how did they feel about you going outdoors? Like, was there ever this pressure to just really go for the comp scene and yeah, actually, I'll leave it at that. I got one more follow-up after that, but I'm just curious what their take was on it.
At Stone Summit, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. Like, did they encourage you to go outside each weekend, or when the season was good, or did they see it as a distraction from your budding competition career?
They were always totally fine with whatever I was motivated on at the time, and I was self motivated enough in competitions where I'm not going to be out in Stoneford or something the days before a comp, but. They also kind of knew that they weren't going to stop me if it was the season from going out and climbing on some rock. They also had a good idea of balance, but they were definitely more competition focused. So a lot of the training that we were doing at the gym was a lot more centered around increasing those competition skills. So I feel like that's kind of what I was focusing on most of the time when I was in there climbing. But at that time, it also wasn't bad training for climbing outside. It kind of hit both sides pretty well. That was a great.
It cracks me up because you made a comment. You said, I was motivated enough for comps that I wouldn't go to Stoneford the day before and, you know, wreck yourself, right? But when you did Grand Illusion, what you did was you went to a comp that morning and then climbed Grand Illusion that afternoon, right? Which I thought was hilarious. First of all, the reason why this really blew my mind is because it showed that I think you were doing lead nationals and you didn't make finals. And then that same day after not making finals, you cruised out and did Grand Illusion, a V16 that it seems kind of almost like a lead national in a way. And it just blew my mind because it showed me both how hard the competition was, you know, that you could go out and do V16 after not qualifying for finals. I'm like, wow, that's must be a tough finals around. And then just, just that you had gas in you. I guess I never thought about doing a competition, not quite getting the result I liked, and then going and climbing and doing V16 that same day. So just a little tangent there, but I thought that was a cool story.
Yeah, that was a really awesome experience for me. It's just kind of funny. It was just a perfect storm having nationals here in Salt Lake. I was able to stay at my own place here, and just kind of leading up into the training for nationals, I was bouldering a lot in the gym, and then also mainly focused on trying to send Grand Illusion. And at this point, I was probably, I'm not even sure, surely over like 15 days deep in trying. And the season that the nationals came around, like it was kind of getting towards the end of the year where the snow was about to come in, and the thing wasn't going to be climbable. So I was always looking for these little weather windows where I had the opportunity to go out and try. And I wasn't the most fit lead climber at the time, but I had been climbing on Grand Illusion, which is it's about 20 moves of just straight power endurance, which is like, it's not the worst for lead fitness, but I felt in really good shape that I could make the final at lead nationals if the crux was, you know, around like 20 moves, but anything out of that, it kind of goes into a different endurance system that I wasn't too tapped into. But anyways, I competed at the lead for that comp and made the semi and was a few spots out of the final, but didn't climb too hard. Didn't like blow myself completely out. And when I came down off the wall, I was like, man, I am like, I feel really primed for a go on my project right now. You know, I kind of got my flash bump out of the way. I had a really good lead warm up and then, you know, climbed a good bit up this lead route. And I was like, I am ready to go. So I got a hold of Bobby. I was like, yo, going up to the prod, so you need to come up here and film this thing. There was a bunch of kids from the comp that were up there at the roof. And I came up and I got there and I was a little bummed. The bottom holds were kind of seeping and a little wet. So I did everything I could to chalk ball them up and get it to a state that was climbable for me. And my feeling when I came down off the wall was right. I pulled on and my first try from the bottom, just like everything connected. I didn't feel like a single bit of fatigue. There wasn't like a single point on the climb that I really had to try. I was just ready to execute. I had everything so dialed and I was fully primed in that power endurance fitness to give a good rip, and everything connected, and it was a really, really cool experience.
Damn, that's a good a good silver lining to that day when you didn't make nationals is to go do Grand Illusion. That's a trip. And I want to maybe circle back to this later, because there's something that we talked about before where you felt like sometimes comps, or one of the issues with comp climbing sometimes is that you can be feeling really strong and really good, and that the result of that day didn't reflect how you felt that day. And clearly you were in good shape. If you went and literally walked up a V16 within hours, it's not like you weren't in good shape when you pulled onto the wall. So I don't know, let's not go down the Grand Illusion rabbit hole anymore, but I think that's just, that'll kind of set that tone for later. So, okay, you're at Stone Summit, you're crushing, having fun. And we were talking about this balance of climbing outdoors and indoors, and something that I think maybe just because I'm from the West Coast, something that was always, we always had like a bit of mystery around the Southeast. And I think it started with Jimmy coming out and just being Jimmy Webb, being the Jimmy Webb that we all know. And I was just wondering how the Southeast kind of shaped your style, or if it did, and if it's connected. Is there anything about that style that feels more similar to comp climbing or really dissimilar? And just, you know, what you think of that whole sandstone world and how it shaped you as a climber?
Yeah. The boulders in the Southeast are amazing. I mean, still, I haven't been to an area that I resonate with in the same way. Like, the stone is awesome and the style is really unique. It's like a very cool blend of like a power and tech and like a subtlety body position type way. And I think that aspect of the style is something that translated really well to climbing in competitions, just being able to like be on the wall and kind of understand like, hey, if I'm over here, like this sloper is like actually like a usable hold, you know? And I think it kind of like, increased my like overall like awareness on the wall and like in a really good way. I think, growing up in another area might've made me stronger at crimps or pulling in like a straightforward style, but the South has this kind of good blend of everything, and all the boulders are striking and aesthetic to me. So it kind of forced me out of my boxes of style and kind of made me a well-rounded climber growing up down there. And also the boulders all being put up by Jimmy and James Litz and all these strong dudes that didn't know how strong they were, kind of like made the whole area really stiff feeling. And I was always like in competitions trying to compare myself to the other kids. And I'm like, oh man, like all these kids that I'm competing against are climbing V13 out here in Colorado. Like, I need to climb V13 too. So if I want to be competitive, so I'd go out to Stoneford and Lily Boulders and try to repeat these really, I didn't even know at the time, but really, really hard V13s that are still some of the hardest boulders that I've ever done. And, I think that like, thinking that I was behind and trying to catch up on these really stout boulders kind of put me in a position where I was like a lot stronger than I thought I was. And it made me really, really competitive. So yeah, I'm really, really grateful to have grown up down there. It was awesome.
Yeah. I like this term that I completely made up. I call it tech burl, where it's like, you have to get into these positions, but then you have to be extremely tight, you know, really engaged for these moves. And I coined that term when I did, oh man, I think it's Golden Harvest. It's like a V10 in Rocktown or something.
Oh yeah.
It's like
classic,
you know, there's like a heel toe cam. It's not that steep and the holds are pretty good, but somehow you just have to be extremely engaged. And it's not that kind of like jump from a crimp and latch. It's this all over body thing, but you have to get those body positions right. But the body position is step one, and then really strong is step two. And I don't know. I love that style. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, it's nice. One thing that's really cool about the Southeast that I've come to realize is the boulders are, everybody talks about how stiff everything is down there and that it's, everything is super hard for the grade, which I don't think is not true, but I think that the just the rock and the boulders just kind of like lend themselves to the subtlety where things just feel stiff and impossible until you climb them, and then all these subtleties click together, and then you like top out and you're like, okay, well, like I could see how that's a V13, even though it took me, you know, 10 days or whatever. Like, it's really weird. You kind of just like make this connection in your brain, and then you're like, do everything just right. And then you're like, okay, yeah, no, that actually is the grade. I thought it was really stiff this whole time, but I changed my mind now that I've done it. It's kind of a weird style in that way, but it's really rewarding when you feel like you've really learned something in order to send.
Yeah, I don't know. When I did a millipede on that same trip, which is a V5 in HP 40, I never felt like I battled that thing. I think it was harder for me than Golden Harvest, but maybe it was conditions. Maybe. And oh yeah, good cameo on Ego Death. Just another shout out to that movie that you were in by Mike Rosato and that whole team. So yeah, I don't know, just random shout out because I love that one.
Yeah, I'm glad you like that. It was really cool to like. I think that video does a really good job at kind of explaining that exact thing that I was talking about. It's like all those boulders at horse bends. Like you watch that video and you're like, this is a V8. You know, there'll be like an intro clip of me falling on it like five times or whatever, and then me sending it, and then you're like, oh, that's only V8. And it kind of like, I think it showcases that style where you really have to like drop the ego and try to like learn what the boulder is asking from you. And then once you do it, you're like, okay, that is the grade. Or maybe it's not. They're probably stiff down there at horse pens, but
there is something, the two things that I love in climbing in general, but I think I experienced it a lot down there is grabbing holds that don't look like holds and then having them work like those slopers. I don't know. They're slopers because you decide to grab them. Otherwise they would just be nothing. But then you put some chalk on there and you say, okay, this is the hold. And then what is amazing is when you do those climbs and you do them well, they really do. They feel easy. And sometimes you tap into that. I did Mortal Kombat that, you know, it's like a V3 arret.
Nice.
Something.
Yeah.
And I'm really proud. I on-sighted it. I know it's a boulder, but I didn't see anyone do it. And I just walked up it and it just actually felt super easy and beautiful. And I was like, ooh, that feeling, that like cruising connection. So yeah, getting my hands all sway. That one was a little spicy too. Of all the South isn't usually known for spicy lines, but I was told that the local ER knew that climb by name, because so many people have wrecked themselves on it. But anyways, yeah.
Yeah, that one's super awesome. Apparently way back in the day, when they did the first descent of that boulder, they actually climbed it from the other side of the arete, which I honestly have no idea why, because if you climb it on one side, you're like standing on the slab the whole time. Mm-hmm. And this way, maybe the hands are a little better, but it's like a little steeper. There's like no landing at all. There's like a huge hit. I have a hard time believing that's how they climb the thing, but that's the rumor from back in the day. There's a lot of those tales from back in the day in the Southeast that you don't know how much is true. Did James Lutz really climb Glide Module with his girlfriend on his back, or did that just get exaggerated out of proportion? So
well, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. Good job, James Lutz. he's a legend in my mind. Okay, well, let's go back to the plastic world. It was interesting hearing how you just kind of really leveled up just being in Stone Summit. It just, I don't know. It's just cool hearing about those times in your life where you get in that team, you have the right coach, and you're just, you know, feeling it. And something that really blew my mind is when you told me your story about Olympics, or sorry, when you told me the story about you thinking about qualifying for the 2020 Olympics. And I hate to make you do this, but are you willing to relive some the almost, and why you were so set up to do well at these Olympics, which is kind of atypical. I think a lot of people weren't looking forward to speed climbing plus lead climbing plus bouldering, but it sounded like the program you were in down Stone Summit really set you up for it.
Yeah. It was really a perfect storm of, of a format for me to try my hand at it, especially in that year, because I was still pretty new to like the open climbing scene, and I had done well at some open bouldering events and done well at some open lead events, but I wasn't like stand out. Like if you looked at just, if it was a single discipline, like pick out thing, I would have been really hard pressed to have a good shot at qualifying. But with the three discipline combined, it was really a perfect storm because Stone Summit always wanted their athletes to at least like, they would really like, if you told Claudio like, hey, I am not a fan of lead climbing, I don't want to lead climb, whatever, it's like you could work around and not do that, but they really tried to put the pressure on to make all the athletes try every discipline of the sport. And we had like a really great speed coach, which was unlike most teams. It's like some nice gyms that are lucky enough to have like the 15 meter speed wall don't have somebody that's like speed knowledgeable to be like, this is the beta that you should use, and looking at coach's eye and slowing it down and be like, your line isn't so straight right here. So having all those resources and stuff, and just me wanting to get better and more dominant at every single facet of climbing I could, I like was always engaged in all of them. And then the Olympic format dropped, and I felt like I had like a good leg up on everybody who was like trying to catch up, especially trying to catch up to be competitive in that speed section. And I ended up being a pretty fast speed climber, and that kind of helped me for out in the combined, because usually the people that were better than me at lead climbing, that was like my weakest discipline. I was usually faster than in speed and was competitive with them in bouldering. So it kind of set me up in a way where like when everything kind of evened out, I was one of the top guys because of my speed and bouldering specialty. It was really a perfect storm that I just happened to be climbing and training in all three, which I feel like a lot of people were more specialized at that time.
Yeah, Zach, when they announced speed climbing was in the Olympics, I realized I had never seen a speed wall in my life in person. It just wasn't one around us. I think one finally got built. I was in the freaking Bay Area. I mean, I was at big gyms. I think one finally got built at like a Ninja Warrior type of gym that wasn't even a rock climbing gym. So yeah, it was not on my radar. So you went to Pan Ams, and it sounded like you got really close. How old were you at the time for this? Because you're still pretty darn young.
Yeah, this was 2020 that we were trying to qualify for the 2020 Olympics. So it was like 2019 and 2020 season. So I was 19 and 20. So still pretty young, but like right at that a good age to be trying to qualify. It was really like everything about it was like a perfect storm of like timing and my strengths, and it just kind of, it played in really well to like give me a good shot. But I think at the time I didn't really realize, because I was still new to the open climbing scene and being one of the top two and in that format in the States kind of just seemed far-fetched until I started competing. And then I went and in order to try to qualify for the team, I went and competed at the it was the combined nationals at the time, which was just a mock combined format. And it was held here in Salt Lake. And I ended up winning the competition. And that's kind of like the first moment where I realized like, oh, like I am capable of doing this. Like if I really lock in and put everything I have into this thing, I think that there's a chance. So yeah, that was a big turning point, pivotal moment for me realizing my dreams.
Yeah, are you willing to share, and we can cut this out if you're not too, are you willing to share what the actual qualifying event looked like? And I think it's interesting for the 2020 Olympics. I think it's interesting because the direction that I was hoping to talk about was just all these nuances in comp climbing that we don't often see as a spectator, and how it can sometimes be frustrating, but you still keep getting up and swinging for things like the Olympics and, you know, the World Cups. And, you know, if you're willing to, I hate making you relive a comp that you didn't win. It's okay if you don't want to go into that.
No, for sure. I'd love to dive a little deeper on that. For me that season, it was a really rough introduction to, I'd competed in a few World Cups before, but I think at that time I had only competed in like the domestic bouldering World Cups, whether that was, I think it was just Vail at this point. We hadn't had a Salt Lake World Cup yet. So I'd only seen the stage just briefly and only in one discipline. And then, 2019, I competed like a full season of World Cups and, got absolutely hosed. You know, I had like a lot of confidence going in that, you know, I was really dominant in the U.S. competitions. There was guys on the U.S. team that were previously really dominant in World Cups. So I was kind of using the transitive property there or whatever and kind of thought like, okay, this is my place too. Like I can be making these finals and getting up on that podium. And then I was just absolutely a fish out of water at the World Cups for that first season. And I was just completely surprised by the level and the difference in style, and it felt like I had like a lot to learn. So I went through the whole season without much success at those like earlier, harder qualification events where I could have gotten a ticket. So it kind of all accumulated down to me competing at the Pan Ams, which was in LA. And the reason that Pan Ams is as a good competition to qualify for a U.S. person is it's essentially a U.S. national. Like there's some strong guys from South America. There's a few strong dudes from Canada as well. But the past 2 years, it's been podium sweeped by U.S. athletes. And from winning that combined competition against all these U.S. athletes, I thought like, you know, this is my spot to do it. I knew I had a really good chance. And the finals, just the way that everything broke down, just happened to really swing it out of my favor. And it was a really weird experience because it started off with that three discipline combined. It starts off with speed climbing as the first discipline you do in the final. And I managed to like get super lucky on my last race. I was racing against this dude, Carlos from Ecuador, I think. And he's the fastest speed climber in the Americas at the time. And he was climbing like, and 5 second times. And I was a fast speed climber for a sport climber. So I was in like my mid sixes and stuff. So I ended up in that finals race and I was like, okay, cool. Like probably got second, but I'm just going to try to go as fast as I absolutely can. And, you can only try in this situation. And, I tried really fast, really hard off the bat, and he kind of immediately ended up slipping, and I kind of see him go up ahead of me, and then I get back on, I start climbing faster again, and then he falls a little bit, and I'm ahead of him, and then we just had this, like, back-and-forth crazy race where we were just slipping all over the place. I ended up winning the race with, like, a 10-second time, and so I was like, all right, well, this is perfect for me. You know, I already have a first-place position in the first discipline, which I wasn't even expecting to win. So I had a lot of confidence going into the bouldering round, and it was a three boulder round. And I don't know what was the setter intention for the round, but I think that they wanted the South Americans and stuff in the final to have like a better chance of getting tops and stuff, but it kind of left it like a really high pressure round for the guys at the top. Cause we came out and, I flashed the first two boulders and, some of the other Americans did too. I think Xander flashed the first two boulders. Sean might've fallen once on the slab and then did the, first try. So we were all like really close within one attempt. And then it all came down to this last boulder that we were hoping was hard and created some separation. And I go to pull on the wall and I just have like one foot on and both my hands on this roof and I'm trying to establish, and I take my other foot off the ground and my foot slips. And so I like just one foot slip gave me an attempt, and I ended up pulling on and doing that boulder second try. But from falling one time in that boulder round, I think I ended up with like a third or fourth place rank and the boulders. So I was still in a good spot, but it was all going to come down to this lead route, and the lead route was and lead was just my worst discipline until this year. I was just absolutely not very competitive as a lead climber, and so I was like really stressed going into this lead route, and ended up climbing really well on it. I think I ended up in third on the route, if I remember correctly. But Colin and Sean both topped this route, and with Colin topping the route and getting a first place there and being higher ranked than me in bouldering, he ended up like just edging me out in the combined score. Yeah, it was a bit of a bummer to be so close. But if that foot didn't slip pulling onto that last boulder, it would have been in the bag for me, which is unfortunate. But
well, thanks for reliving it. Sorry to make you relive that heartbreaker. But I think first I want to say that you mentioned that the bouldering round was high pressure, and just to clarify what that means is I think what you mean by it is that the boulders were too easy. So there wasn't a bunch of separation that happened naturally. It was basically like, if you have the most tiny foot slip, then, and you have one fall, all of a sudden you said third or fourth one, you know, did you really fail on the boulder? I mean, you did, your foot popped, like, it's, you know, you weren't there, but it's just probably frustrating to, yeah, that just doesn't feel so great. Like that feels like maybe the setting didn't reward the strengths that you brought that day. And so, yeah, I wanted to hear this because I thought it would be interesting to go into the role setting plays in competitions and the role and the changes that we've seen in setting, and, you know, why the World Cup season was so difficult for you or these other boulders when, you know, I like your transitive property. You said, hey, look, I'm beating these people. I'm stronger than them today on these national boulders, and they've done well on these World Cup boulders. So, you know, that makes sense. You know, if A is more than B, I'm not doing any of that on the podcast. And so, yeah, maybe we can go then into that World Cup season. I think it was after those Pan Ams, and just kind of the meta that you discovered and just what's really like out there on the World Cup circuit.
Yeah. You know, it's the World Cup circuit these days is a crazy thing. And it's its own beast from any other competition series, anywhere else in the States for sure. Yeah, it's crazy. It's definitely like the pinnacle of competition climbing. All the strongest dudes are there. And I think with such a strong field, this year, the route setters had, they just kind of every year they have an increasingly harder and harder time separating people on these very like basic skills. It's just hard for them to like know the line and like know how tired someone's going to be or like know how fresh someone's going to be. So a lot of the boulders this season, what I came to realize extremely fast were, and everything that they were asking was some type of like coordination or risk involved. And that's like a way that like the route setters can like introduce like difficulty to a climb in a way without like, you know, making the crimps farther apart or something. They just, everything this year really felt like a test of subtlety, but also just straight risk. And it's not a style that you can't be dominant in. There's people that were extremely consistent finalists this season that really had the style figured out, but I felt like it was pretty one-sided and leaned towards that because that was the way that the route setters knew that they were going to be able to set the best separated competition. So that was a really hard thing for me to like figure out and learn, because I was training really hard physically for the year. I felt way stronger than I ever have. I was doing really good on these jumps that required a lot of like strength and all these like American style boulders, I guess. And you know, I thought I was in a really good place to compete, and then got spanked again at all the World Cups except for the one that was here in the States and set by American setters, which is pretty funny. But yeah, it was a really hard style for me to adapt to, and I definitely got better at it as the season went on. But going into the season and not expecting it on the level that it was at definitely threw me for a loop, and it was hard for me to adapt.
You're kind of echoing some stuff that Nathaniel Coleman talked about, who did really well in nationals. And it's not to say that he did poorly on the World Cup scene or the Olympic scene. Definitely did just fine there. I just think it's fun to hear these behind the scenes. And I also just want to make a point that we can critique this stuff without saying that it's bad. It's more just, this is the way it is. And it's interesting to understand, I think, from a spectator position, where, like, you know, what does it mean to be strong? And what does it mean to be good at coordination? And how are those linked? And what is the World Cup testing? And, you know, I think when you come in understanding what it's looking for, it gives you both an appreciation for what it is, but also an understanding why maybe your favorite super strong rock climber, aka Zach Gall, doesn't always do, you know, doesn't show up in the way that you just saw him show up at nationals or something. And I would love it if you shared that breakdown. You told me that you went and you saw the four bays and you just somehow figured out the meta super quick of what was expected. And that just cracked me up that you guys came in just, oh, this is what they're looking for. And maybe you could share what it was that they were looking for on those four bays.
Yeah. So it was kind of funny. It's like, we realized this theme very early on in the season, and we were trying to play a lot of catch up when we had time back here in Salt Lake. And Josh was doing an amazing job trying to set boulders with this like weird, like subtle style that is all about like execution and being confident on these like, on these risky moves and stuff. It was funny after like kind of reading into this for an entire season, it kind of all accumulated in the World Championships, which was the first Olympic qualifying event. And the final, like all of the semifinal and final rounds for the individual disciplines and all the combined rounds were on this same short four bay wall. And kind of just watching all these rounds play out, after a few of them, you kind of started to realize like, hey, they're setting the exact same boulder essentially on every single bay of this boulder wall. And I think the setters found out a formula very early on that was working well in terms of separation and had some diversity, quote unquote, but it made it really predictable to where when you looked at the slab on the left side of the wall, you knew that it was going to start on one or the other sides of the wall. You were going to do some type of either cordo stand up or stand up onto the slab. And then you were going to walk across a series of bad smeary feet, like a volume shadow walk type of situation. And that was consistent with every single boulder that was on that wall for the competition. And then there was on the opposite side of the bouldering wall, there was this wall that was really cool. It was like, I was really excited to see some cool climbing incorporated on this thing, but it was like a really nice, like it was like vert and then like kind of like a 60 that went like horizontal, but you kind of climbed in it like a roof. And then it had like a less steep head wall section on top of it. And kind of every boulder that was over there was just like one kind of funny jump that people seemed to not struggle with to kind of get you out of the roof. And then it was some like sloper friction climbing once you turned the head wall, and that was consistent with every boulder that was set on that wall. And then one lane over from that in the middle was this slightly overhanging wall that was like the power bay, and typically this was like what we'd look at as more like straightforward power style climbing, but still just fiberglass open hand things. There was a really consistent theme the entire World Cup season where I think the setters realized like if they used these slopier new fiberglass holds and didn't give people thumbs, it took out a lot of the strong people's ability to be able to like really own a hold and annihilate a move without finding the best position. So everything was like this open-handed sloper grip type where you really just had to be in the right position and have the right type of skin to be able to like stick to these holds and make it happen. And then the final bay was like this subtle dihedral. And this one was, I guess, this was just always the coordination bay, but it became like the most apparent in those combined rounds where there was three zones. This boulder was always a triple coordination. So you would do a cordo, swing down, move to the 5-point zone, and then you do like a cordo paddle move to the 10-point zone, and then like another type of coordination move to the finish hold. And so just kind of as that competition went on, you knew exactly, you could really pick up on these patterns, and you knew exactly what you were going to get on each one of these, on each one of these bays, which took a lot of the element of like surprise, and it felt like not super diverse in that way.
It's just cool that you were able to dissect it like that. It also, I don't know, just again, as a spectator, it's going to make me look at the whole thing differently. I just want to ask more about, so you're talking about fiberglass and then not being able to get your thumb on there. And you said that when you can get your thumb on there, you don't have to find the perfect body position. And I just want to pick that a little bit deeper. Like, what does it mean to have holds that are a little more in cut or have a thumb? Like, how does that change what the style is like? Like, what do you get to do that's so different compared to just these body positions? And you know, how come, you know, do you like that style more, or should we see it more?
That's it was kind of my biggest gripe with the round setting this season, was not having these more in cut holds or holds that you could really like grab onto and dominate. And I think that it creates a style that, like you were just saying, is a lot more subtle, and you have to like work into these body positions and stuff. And it makes like the answer to the all the problems like a lot harder to find for someone like myself. But typically, like if you have a hold that's like more in cut or has like some thumb that you can really pinch and own the hold, you can use your strength to kind of take out a lot of the subtlety. And they didn't give you any opportunities to do that on this World Cup series, which is, it's cool that they really like made you find a very specific, correct way to climb the boulder, but it kind of like took out a lot of the aspects of climbing that me and you enjoy the most, which is just kind of thugging around and really showing off your strengths on stuff, which I think is really entertaining to watch on a World Cup level. And I'm sure that it's really hard to set and find that line between like what is going to get absolutely annihilated and flashed by all the strong guys in the field and what is and you know, what's going to be too hard for people to do. But there is like a pretty wide grade range of straightforward boulders that I feel like would separate out even these top athletes in a way that people might not expect. So I was definitely a little bummed to see them step away and not try at that style in any way.
Yeah, because I don't know if I we always hear this setter refrain that everyone's too strong, and so we have to use these things to separate them. But we were talking about this where some people are really strong at pinches. Some people are really strong at crimps. Some people are really strong at slopers or toe hooks or something like that. And that, I don't know, it doesn't seem to me like you can't separate a field based on strength. And obviously, like, strength is not somehow completely divorced from technique. Like, it's always this spectrum. And so I guess this is what I'm curious about, is I'd love to see that showcase of strength in a wide variety of different strengths. And yeah, I guess, what are your thoughts? Like, is there ways to test power and strength that not everyone can do? Like, could Daniel Woods do something that you couldn't do, and you could do something that Daniel couldn't do, yet they were both kind of quote unquote powerful?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's like a lot of variety to a powerful style that doesn't, it's not like the boulders don't have to be pass fail. Like, you must be this strong to send. It's like, I think that you can set these boulders in a similar style to how they're setting things now, but while giving people the advantage of being more fit to like you know, you kind of have more wiggle room and room for error if you're able to like overcompensate and like not find these direct positions. But if it comes to like, you know, mini pinches and keeping far foot tension, like Daniel is surely the best in the world. And there's setters out there that know how, that know that level that Daniel's able to climb at, and they could totally set a boulder that Daniel would annihilate and nobody else could touch, you know? And I think that like, there are people out there that can set these things, and they would be a pleasure to watch everybody trying super hard at their best style. And I don't think that this new style has no place in climbing. I think it's a really cool thing to test, and it's obviously something that you can master. Like people like Mejdi and Doyun Lee, Serrato have all like shown that they really have figured out what the setters are asking for them over this past year, and they like mastered it, and they're like, they're incredible at the style. But then there's also people like Daniel who just almost don't, even though he's still, you know, maybe the strongest climber in the world, he just wouldn't fit into the World Cup mold anymore. And it's a little bit of a bummer to see that there's somebody who's so dominant and at the top of what he's the best at not be able to showcase himself on that level if he wanted to, just because the style has gone so far left.
Yeah, I remember talking to Jamie Emerson, who has chiefed a bunch of nationals, and I don't want to say which credentials he has. He has a lot of experience setting for competitions as well as commercially, and he was good friends with Daniel, or is good friends with Daniel, and we used him as an example for. He's like, I could set something that would showcase Daniel being Daniel, and it would be incredible. You know, it would showcase something that is just unbelievable. And so, anyways, I think there's room for some other kinds of competitions. I know there's some murmurs. I didn't share this with you before, but I know there's some murmurs of stuff being worked on to maybe showcase those kind of strengths. But anyways, I just want to play devil's advocate though on this, because even though I think it's no secret, as I introduced my you with my love of just brutal raw power, I love that style. I mean, maybe it's because it's something I'm better at than this really subtle thing. I just want to play devil's advocate and say, like, if what they're exploring in this style of setting and in this indoor world where we can really go deep down these rabbit holes because it's all manufactured and man-made, so we can experiment, is really finding optimal positions and optimal commitment. You know, there's something beautiful there also about taking strength out of the equation, because then theoretically, you can get that right and then add strength on top of it and do things that are incredible. And the reason why I'm bringing it up to you especially is because while we're sitting here critiquing competition climbing, you're still in it. You're still psyched and you're still out there on projects. And I guess, you know, seeing that crossover or how they build on each other, you know, I guess I just was wondering, again, to play devil's advocate, like maybe that's exactly what we should be testing indoors, is that the pinnacle of finding the subtlety. And I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I think that, I guess my main big takeaway is I think that it is something that should be represented more in climbing gyms. Like there should be boulders that are like, especially in the States, you see a lot of gyms setting like competition style boulders, and they kind of look like comp boulders. There's fiberglass and volumes all over the wall, but you're really able to like compensate with your strength to do these coordination moves. You know, you can like do the jump and have your hips like slightly in the wrong spot, but like get the hold really well and then just kind of vice grip it down and make up for being in the wrong place when you get there. And a real World Cup boulder like that is completely taken out. Like you need to execute the move like absolutely perfectly, and you kind of land in this position where just sometimes it works, and maybe it's not so strenuous when you do it, but finding that is the crux of this new age style of bouldering. And I don't think that it's I think that it's something that should definitely continue being expanded on. And like, I'd love to see what the human potential of the highest level of this style would be like on a World Cup circuit. And I'd love for there to be one of these boulders that like Serrato is able to flash and nobody can touch, so he can really show off and showcase his style. But it's really alienating a lot of people who are dominant in other facets of the sport and different hold types that is a bit of a bummer to me. It's like, I'd like to see like that continue to be expanded on, but this other side of climbing that people typically really like and watch and love to watch and love to climb on, and people are really strong at, like, I'd love to see those things being expanded on the world stage as well. And it's a bit of a bummer to see it kind of get shifted into this like one-sided type of thing, but I don't think that that side is invalid. And I think that there should be elements of that that are asked on all boulders. You know, it shouldn't be just a straightforward challenge, and it shouldn't be just a technical challenge, but like the blend of strength and technique is what I think like defines climbing in the best way. And I think that that's how it should be represented outside and inside, you know?
Yeah, I really, that was well said. I agree. I think that this goes into just general route setting stuff where I think we all agree that good climbs often test a multitude of skills. I mean, sometimes it's cool to have these specific moves. I don't know why this is the climb coming to mind for me, but there's this climb called Act Right in Red Rocks. That's just kind of, you jump from one crimp to another crimp. And so it's very a distilled version, but I would argue that in general, when we think of good climbs, classic climbs, test pieces, they often incorporate a multitude of abilities. And it's fun when you have some thuggy power problem that then you hit the head wall and all of a sudden you have to be delicate, calm down, take your time, really, you know, embrace technique. So yeah, the reason why I think that would be so cool too is that you made a point when we were last chatting about how the average climber in the gym doesn't even know who's winning the World Cups. Like if you were to ask someone, hey, you know, I would say the name Daniel Woods is more likely to come up if you were to talk about high level climbing than Serrato. And that's not to say Daniel Woods is the best. It's not to say Serrato is the best. It's just to say that the average person isn't even watching World Cups, isn't really tapped into that. And you know why? I don't think we really know why it is, but it's a shame because you guys are out there competing on the highest stage with amazing other climbers.
Yeah, I think a lot of just recreational climbers and even just really strong climbers who frequent the gym and are really into the sport or into, you know, like getting better at rock climbing or just getting better at climbing within their gym, and they're focused on their progression in that way. And since the World Cup style has shifted so much, it's like hard to watch even from like a very dedicated rock climber. It's hard for them to like watch a World Cup and feel like connected to it in any way. It looks like a different sport. They're not climbing on things that are similar. They don't really have like reference to know how hard stuff is. But I think if the style was shifted back into like an extremely hard version of what people are used to climbing on, then they'd be able to tell like, wow, like that is badass and impressive. Like what Sean Bailey did on this boulder, like him jumping and swinging on that edge with one hand is like, I know like what that hold is, and it's crazy that he was able to jump to it, you know? But I think that there's just like a big disconnect of the style that makes people just feel extremely out of touch of it. And I also think it's just not really like competition climbing is just not promoted on social media and like the best way. It's really hard to stay tapped in and figure out what's going on. And especially with Olympic qualification stuff, like people, like just talking to people in Salt Lake before I go to a comp, they have no idea like what Olympic qualification comps are coming up or how you have to place in order to qualify. Like people are very out of touch, and this information just isn't easily accessible for people to find, to, you know, have that connection and be like, oh, I want to know what's going on at this comp. I know that, you know, the podium of this comp makes it to the Olympics and the winner of this one makes it to the Olympics. I think like all that information is kind of like hidden away in a weird way that makes it hard for people to like stay on top of and pay attention to.
Dude, if the scene at Salt Lake doesn't know it, then yeah, we really don't know it. Because I didn't, when, you know, we had Jesse on here and Jesse won the Pan Ams and got a spot in the Olympics, and I had no idea that the Pan Ams were ever even coming up. I mean, I'm not as tapped in as others, but I love climbing, man. I mean, I'm on climbing media all day, every day, and I had no idea that that was coming up. So, yeah, I don't, the last thing I wanted to mention is that you again, we're critiquing this stuff, but you still went all in on trying to qualify for these last Olympics. And, you know, I know you didn't win the Pan Ams, so you didn't get that ticket, but you were climbing really well there and you worked really hard at. But a comment that you made that just kind of encompasses everything that we're talking about is you called it a grind, the training for it. And what I think maybe people initially might think, it's like, oh, you had to do a lot of two-a-days or something like that. But what's interesting is that you described the training as being a lot of these more compy style, these balance-oriented things. And your complaint to me, which I love, was that your fingers weren't even sore. Like you felt like you weren't in the, you know, I think when people hear the word grind, they're like, oh, we must be hangboarding a lot, doing a lot of pull-ups. And it was like the opposite. You're like, I was a grind because you didn't really feel like you were digging in and doing classic climbing. And yeah, I just thought that was interesting to use that term, grind.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely felt like a grind where I really had to put my head down and lock into all these things that I didn't appreciate as much in the climbing world. I think overall it's made me a lot better of a climber, but maybe not as strong of a climber. For me, like going into the gym and growing up, I always had just a huge emphasis on like training. You know, I wanted to be like able to one arm pull up 10 times on a certain edge, or, you know, I had these like strength metrics that I was always trying to achieve, to where it's like, I was like, if I'm this strong, then I'll be able to send this hard. And I think that, I mean, that's kind of a skewed way of looking at any type of climbing. Like you definitely want to have that balance, but my focus was like majorly shifted this year into the practicing element of climbing. And I think that's what benefits you the most as a World Cup climber these days, is like trying to expose yourself to these new style of movements and really dial them in and understand like why they work, when they work, and what made you fall when they don't work. And that was kind of what I was focusing on gearing up, especially for bouldering for this qualification year. And I felt like I was clocking a lot of hours in at the TC, just climbing on, trying to walk across some slab or stand on some super low angle, shitty volume, and, you know, both my feet blowing out and scraping my shins and doing that, you know, 100 times until both my feet stuck and I was able to move around a little bit. So just kind of like all of these little practice and subtle elements is what I was focused on. And so you leave the gym from doing something like that and it doesn't really feel like you got the best sesh, because you're not leaving like all sore and beat up, but you definitely learn something. And I think that that made it a bit of a grind for me, because I really enjoy, you know, I grew up, both of my parents were competitive bodybuilders, so they had like a huge fitness background. My mom was like a personal trainer at a gym, and both my parents, I'll have to send you a picture after this, but they were both absolutely yoked, shredded, awesome. Spray tanned up, standing on stage and stuff. But anyways, from my whole upbringing and climbing, they, and them not knowing about it as much, they always had like a very strength oriented background and kind of like input on my training. So I think that's kind of what developed me into like a stronger climber, is, you know, my parents were always very up on top of like supplementation and making sure I was getting enough protein, we're eating good meals. I'm always going to the gym and I'm climbing and I'm lifting and I'm doing all these things to make me really strong. But this year it was just a complete 180 from that. And it was just fully focused on the other side of skill and climbing.
That's awesome. I just got to ask, can you do 10 one-arm pull-ups? And if you can you do it on an edge?
I think I've done 5 on the Peacemaker middle edge, but I've done 10 on a, bar with both hands. So, and that was pretty recent. That was actually I decided like I wanted to leave the gym tired one of the days leading up to training for the Olympics. I was like, I'm going to do something right before I leave to figure out like, or just to like make sure that I'm still strong. And I grabbed a bar in the TC and I did 10 one arms for the first time. And then I came down, and I was like, man, I wonder if I could do it on my non-dominant side. And I cranked out 10 on the other side as well. And I was like, well, I'm still strong, and now I'm a little tired leaving the gym, but
okay. Yeah, that's kind of wild, man. I do have this memory of you getting shoulder surgery, and the reason why I remember that is because I got shoulder surgery not long after you, and watching you just doing one arms on some bar with your, you know, non-surgery arm, and I was sitting there on the couch like eating ice cream and in pain. I was like, I should be doing that too, but I'm not. So yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, my right arm was always dominant until I got my shoulder surgery, and then I just couldn't stop training. So I was doing whatever I could on my left arm, and now my left arm is my stronger side. It's kind of funny.
I like that. Just couldn't stop training. Well, I hear I'm just talking up your amazing power, and then but what you just told me is you're like, yeah, dude. But then I was in the TC. I was getting my technique up, and it just cracks me up how. I just want to like always talk about power, and people probably hear this podcast and they're like, geez, like Tim and Josh talk a lot about technique and mental side of things, you know, isn't strength important? And the thing is that I think that strength is super important, and I probably have leaned into it too much. And that's where these moments where you go like, oh yeah, like I need to be able to stand on really small foot chips. And so just like you bringing that in, figuring that out. And I want to transition into your outdoor goals right now, because I know you're not done with the comp scene, but you know, didn't get first in the Pan Ams that just happened. You still, I think you got third or second, right? You still podiumed, among highest stacked
third place.
Congrats on that. I'm sorry you didn't get to the Olympics, man, but still really badass. And I know you're doing a little more outdoor climbing. We started out by talking about some of your recent projects, but yeah, what's on the list now while you got, I mean, you don't have 4 years until you may have 4 years until the next Olympics, but I'm sure that you're still going to check out team trials and everything. But in the meantime, what are you focusing on?
Yeah, I definitely, just kind of this entire season, and I'm sure it didn't help me with my best competition performance, but I knew that like in the back of my mind, if I guess the way that I was thinking about the whole season was, if I knew that the entire time, if I had a choice, and I like my main goal is to be able to climb on whatever it is. I just love climbing, but I just want to be able to do that all the time and make a career for myself where I don't have to do anything else but worry about climbing. And I saw the Olympics as like my ticket to be able to do that. But when I really broke it down and thought about what my pure motivations are within the sport, I knew I just wanted to be climbing outside the whole time. And now that this season is done and over, and I'm able to take a step back and kind of like take it all in, and what my pure motivations are and why I really love the sport, I've quickly realized it's because of this outdoor climbing aspect. And so I need to dive back in, and I have like a lot of things on my list that I really want to go and try, starting with like just a few, just trying to repeat a few classic hard boulders to kind of like get a feel of where I'm at and kind of like build my pyramid and scorecard and see some new areas. And then, stemming from that, I'm really stoked to get out there and hike around in the woods and try to find a cool project for myself and something to give back to the community on the harder end. So yeah, just right. Deep in the mode of outdoor bouldering and trying to also use this lead fitness that I've accumulated from this combined training to maybe do some roots too. I don't want to let it go completely to waste. So,
dude, I know I just switched to outdoor mode, but I feel like something we didn't describe well enough in the comp scene that can be frustrating is that when you were sharing some of the like really details and stories with me, it's that you would show up, feel strong, and then something wouldn't necessarily go your way. And it's like that roll of the dice feeling where, oh, you know, that round you talked about in the Pan Ams, how it was a high pressure round. And so 1 foot slip meant that it wasn't going to happen. And I find that really different from outdoor climbing where you get out what you put in.
Yeah, big switch in mindset. I think that I always put a lot of pressure on myself for climbing outside. I think I climb well under pressure, and that's what's made me successful in competitions. And I think it helps me send harder boulders fast. But yeah, that knowing that it's always going to be there and being able to come back definitely like alleviates that and kind of changes the mental game of the top end of both sides like drastically. It's night and day. It's really frustrating in competitions when you feel like you have all the tools and everything, and you're feeling really fit and everything is like lining up for it to be your day, and something goes wrong and it doesn't happen. Or sometimes you show up and it's really like nothing feels right and it just doesn't seem like it's going to work. But then you get out on the mats and everything clicks and you're like, hell yeah, this is like it makes no sense. And, I don't know, that competition success feels really good. But, for me, like, the longer it takes me to do something like Grand Illusion, where I put in, you know, over 15, close to 20 days, probably, the feeling of doing that is always going to outweigh doing something that was hard for me to do in 4 minutes, you know, and really like accomplishing those like long-term goals where you put like all the effort in and you can see your progress and it all like accumulates in one moment. It's just it just feels overwhelmingly good to me to send something like that I put that much time and effort into.
Well, what's interesting too, and you brought this up earlier, was that if you do really well outdoors and you put up an amazing FA or you repeat something that's super classic, it actually somehow makes a mark in history and your climbing legacy more than competitions do. And it's funny because, you know, who won the World Cup at Bern, like 2 years ago, like, I don't know, even though that was an incredible thing to do. And it's fascinating that if you want to leave your mark on climbing, it's that showing up, finding that piece of rock or repeating that beautiful thing and putting in that effort that really kind of lives forever. And so I'm not surprised that you're drawn to that, because if you're going to put in that effort, you know, you may have comment, if I'm going to dial myself into one project, I want it to be mega. And yeah, I don't know. I guess you're doing that right now on a few different things, but any other ones come to mind that you want to make your mark on?
Yeah, definitely. I think that the things that inspire me the most are things that people don't see often, whether that's repeating like a boulder that's already been established but's unrepeated and just hasn't been showcased really well. Like, I want to like bring life back to those classic hard boulders that haven't seen much attention. And then outside of that, even better is finding something that nobody has done or seen before and climbing that and getting to showcase that and leave that for the climbing community to come and test themselves on. But I guess in specific, the things that I've been trying recently has been, I put in a lot of work to this thing up in Little Cottonwood Canyon that we talked about in the beginning of the podcast. And I put a lot of work into that, maybe about 10 days or so. And it's been like a really complicated and tricky process, because it's a super hard boulder, but it's really condensed and it's in this granite tech style that just makes it like really hard to execute. And so I've been climbing on that thing for a while, and I was really close to doing the first ascent, and I invited my friend Sean Bailey up to come and try it with me, and we tried together for like 5 days, and he made like very linear progress and sent the thing, which was super impressive. He called it the what doors jerk. Of perception. Yeah, I know. It was my fault. It was my fault for hyping it up to him.
Yeah, no, good job, Sean.
But it was an impressive thing to watch. And I definitely needed, I was at a point in my process where I really needed an outside perspective on just how this thing was going to go, if I was missing something, because it's so like, it's so tech that just the most minute difference can, you know, change it a whole grade or something. And I think we kind of found, like, trying it together definitely helped my process a lot. And one of the footholds that I used ended up breaking off, and so I had to go and end up trying with the beta that Sean climbed the boulder with for for a while. And so it was just, it was really beneficial to like get to try and work on that, that thing with them. But that, that's one of those that, even though it's not a, not a first ascent, I was there in the developing process to make the thing climbable. And I feel like I definitely contributed a lot to making that thing go. And I feel like attached to that boulder in a way that is really special, and I can't wait to climb it soon. I'm feeling pretty confident. So
nice. Nice. Yeah, it makes me think of how you've just always had this great confidence around doing boulders. You know, you told me how even when you were a little kid, you would see videos of a boulder and you thought somewhere deep inside you that you could do it too, given the work, you know, putting in the work, and that just anything seemed possible. I think that's actually just a prerequisite for doing well at anything, is having that confidence. But I guess I'm curious, now that you have proved to yourself that you can go and do things that you thought were possible, like you mentioned doing the game, after watching that video a long time ago of Daniel doing it, you're like, oh, I can do the game probably. And then you went and did it. But now you're pressing into a area that's a little more uncertain, right? Like going up to a project, like how do you tackle that uncertainty? Like how are you navigating this next stage in your career where it sounds to me like you have confidence that you can go and repeat things that you're attracted to and want to do, but going and building new thing, or, you know, climbing new things is a different stage.
Yeah, for sure. It's like, so it's a lot easier for me to convince myself that I'm capable of doing something if it's already been done. You know that it's possible. You're like, a person can do this. You're like, I'm a strong climber too. And if I put in the work, like I know that I'll be able to climb it as well. But yeah, climbing on projects is kind of a different mindset. It kind of starts off like more fun and explorative. Like you're just kind of like trying to test out all the waters and try like find all these options and stuff. And I think a lot of my process is honestly pretty similar, trying a project to trying something that's hard and has already been established, because I'm always looking for something that's going to suit me a little bit better anyways. So I feel like from learning how to find my own betas on established climbs, it's allowed me to like find my best method on something that nobody has climbed before. But surely it's a different process on the mental side of things, like especially when you're trying a project that's at your limit. It's hard to imagine that it's possible when you haven't seen someone climb it. So yeah, that definitely is like it's a different mental game going into climbing on a project versus climbing on a hard established boulder. But it's cool, and I've been really enjoying it. A lot of like pressure gone in some ways climbing on projects. You're like, I don't know, it's just you and you're the first one to try this thing, and it's a cool feeling.
Oh, that's cool that you can, there's a little, it's like ego death there where it's just, okay, it's just me and the boulder. But I just got to commend you for leaning into that, because one of our subtopics here is always how I go from good to great. And just to me, when I think of the climbers who I look up to most in history, it's people who really push the bounds of what's possible. And it is very different to show up and do something someone else has done. It's just that, you know, even if it's a lower grade than maybe has ever been done before, there's something about being confident that you can solve this and you have the power to push into what's new that I think is really special. And that's why guys like Chris Sharma will always be implanted in the climbing psych, where it's like 15A. It sounds dumb saying like, are humans capable of 15A now with Andra flashing 15A, but you, when you really put your mind into this, you think, okay, well, someone's going to come along and, you know, do 16A, and it seems wild right now and seems impossible. And you could maybe even say 17A at some point. And so being the kind of person who pushes into the unknown and then comes out the other side with confidence, I'm going to just watch that closely as you change into that new mindset, because it's what will make you great, man. And I mean, and you're well on your way, of course.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I definitely enjoy that part of climbing, and I feel like it has a lot more longevity, and just you can always, if you enjoy the developing part of climbing, you can always enjoy going out and climbing on new stuff and contributing and giving back to the community. It's something that you can do forever on any level. It just happens to be right now that I'm in my physical prime or close to it, just in those years. Like, I want to be like developing and trying to send the hardest things that I can and am capable of now. And then, and it's been a really nice, switch, from the competition. I feel like I needed to let go of like that competitive mindset, in order to like relax and remember why I enjoy climbing. And, I think climbing outside and climbing on new stuff is like what's been really, helpful for me to like step away from that. So
I still think you got a few years left for your physical peak. It's interesting seeing guys like Daniel Woods, who is known for his strength. And then, did he get any stronger since he was, 23? Like, I don't know if he ever got any stronger, but it's interesting seeing them continue to progress and climb at a high level for a long time. And so, don't worry, man. You'll be plenty strong for a long time. And this just, this is kind of a 180 from outdoor climbing and even comp climbing. But I just got to ask you, because we're talking about physical peak, I got to ask you about board climbing a little bit, because I just am curious how it fits into your life. I saw that video you did with Tension, and me and Tim just talked about it a ton. I can't, Board Lords, that's what it was. And just,
yeah.
What do you think of board climbing? Like, how does it fit into you as a climber?
Oh, I've always loved like climbing on spray walls and standardized boards. Like, I just think the style is like really good and easy for you to like pick out and isolate certain things that you want to specifically work on, especially in a training for a climbing outside scenario or just like general climbing fitness. I just think it's the best way to really like isolate your weaknesses and try to perfect them. But yeah, I've been exclusively climbing on the Tension 2 and the spray wall since I've transitioned from climbing in comps to climbing outside. And it's been like game changer for leveling up just my like straightforward rock climbing strength. The Tension 2 has been an amazing tool for my climbing. I think the thing that speaks to me the most about the board is, out of all the options there are now, it's the most diverse. So you can isolate and work on the most variety of specific types of movements on the Tension. On like something like the Kilter, you can get really powerful and good at smashing around and using like creating like tension on these big feet. And then the Moonboard is like really nice for these like just awkward hold types, and you're just like, it makes your joints hurt and you're always like exploding from these weird positions and creating movement out of nothing. And I think that there's like there's a lot of merit to that too, but both of those boards are surely not as capable of getting you better at everything like the Tension is. And I feel like out of all of them, the Tension just as a general style is a lot more applicable to climbing outside than anything else, with these really bad footholds and just big vast variety of hold types. There's plastic and wood, and all of the crimps are like different size. Some of them you can only half crimp, some of them you can close down. And so I feel like it gets you better just in general. It climbs the most like a spray wall with the variety that's on there.
That's awesome. It cracks me up how whenever people describe these different boards, it's like Kilter, the word I'm gonna say is powerful, and then it's like Moonboard, the word I'm gonna say is awkward. Like, if you only choose one word, it seems to encompass these things. And I love hearing the whole TB2 just dissection. And I have to ask, because I saw that video where you guys were climbing, you and a whole crew at Tension on the TB2, and those climbs were graded, I don't know, V14, 8B plus or so. And just like, how did those grades translate to outdoors, actually, and how do they translate to the Kilter and the Moonboard? Like, what does it mean to climb V14 on the Tension board too? Like, were those V14, or I know it's kind of like almost a little microcosm, but just your thoughts on grading on this.
Yeah. The grades on the TB2 I found are like the most accurate of the boards. Like they're the most like direct. Like I think there's been like a big connotation, especially like I think it started with the moon board being like the first standardized board of that kind. All the boulders are just nails hard. Like I was trying to warm up on the moon board the other day and I just like put on V4 and I was like, like I was like thrutching, like I couldn't, like, you know, normally it's like I could lock off every move on a V4. I'm like kind of smashing around on like the yellow holds and ISOing stuff. I'm like, this is just certainly not a V4, you know? And I think the tension board is a lot more accurate in the sense that like if you climb a certain grade on the board, you're surely capable of climbing that outside. So I think that the grades are a little bit more based and as like what they would be as rock climbs and not like board grades, which are typically like a few grades sandbagged. But those boulders were extremely, extremely hard. I think I ended up doing the first descent of the first boulder on the mirrored layout. I think it was like 10,000 days or yeah, 10,000 days. And Mike set those and he kind of knew that one. He was intending on setting both of them as 8C. And that was kind of like, he was trying to make both of these boulders V15. And he kind of had a feeling that one was going to be on the softer side or probably 14. And I ended up climbing it really fast. I logged it as 13 on the app. And then Ben Burke climbed it and he kind of thought the same thing, like higher end 13, maybe 14. And then Noah Wheeler also, I like went and looked at the app the other day to see if anybody had repeated and climbed it yet. And the only other log descent is Noah. And he said 13/14. So that one was definitely on like the easier side, but still nails hard. And surely V14, if you kicked it back, you know, 5 more degrees or something. And then the boulder on the spray layout that we all tried at the end and none of us did was like, no doubt in my mind, at least V15, which is something that's really cool about the tension board is none of the moves are very big on that thing. It's just all the hold positions and the feet are like just bad. And it's like, it's really cool how on that board you can set stuff that really like builds onto each other and everything is extremely workable. I went back and I listened to y'all's podcast talking about the boards and Tim was talking about like, he's like, yeah, like I'm sure that boulder is 8C, but it's probably easier to send than a V13 two move thing on the moon board. Like a lot of those boulders are like extremely pass fail. There's always like one move that's like extremely heinous and you just can't really like work it in a way. It's like, you're kind of like strong enough to do it or you're not strong enough to do it. And maybe if you're strong enough to do it, it feels V13. But with a lot of these harder boulders on the tension, you're able to set them in a way where the moves really like build on each other. And you can create something that's extremely workable, but also really, really hard, which is awesome. And I think that it like aligns with climbing outside a lot more often than doing one heinous move. A lot of the harder boulders these days that people are putting up and getting psyched to climb on are like linking a bunch of like pretty hard moves together, and it creates something that's like that's extremely hard. And I think that's a style that a lot of people enjoy.
That's really cool. Thanks for giving that behind the scenes on that, because I guess the reason why it's so interesting seeing a boulder on the tension board being 8C is just how many times indoors do you actually see a V15 or a V16 set and people working on it? Like I like seeing this as a possibility and being pushed forward. And I, you know, whether you can, I don't know, this is all just opinion, but my hunch is that the first V18 ever climbed will probably be indoors. Like, it's like, cause you can set and you can create it, and whether or not that's a real V18 or not is a whole, you know, other rabbit hole we could go down. But I just love seeing people really climbing hard indoors, like it, and really pushing that. And so it was really fun to see that. And I liked your breakdown about it's tricky to say, like, how is it easier to do a V15 on the tension versus a V13 on the moon board? And that doesn't quite capture what we're saying. It was this idea that if there's one V13 move where everything has to go just perfectly and you have to be extremely strong, maybe that doesn't come together so quick, where if you can sit there and spend a bunch of sessions figuring out the micro beta for V12 after V12 after V12 move, and then that stacks up to be more difficult, but it's easier to work. So that was just really cool hearing you break that down.
Yeah, I always think about it like this analogy that for climbing gyms, that I think is the reason why a lot of the Japanese climbers that climb at B Pump are so good, is like, you know, like if you have a goldfish and you put it in like a small bowl, it's only going to grow to like be an acceptable size for that bowl. But you give a goldfish like a big tank and those things get huge. And I think that climbing gyms kind of work the same way. And like this upper level, like the black tapes at B Pump and stuff, are like, a lot of them are probably like V14, V15 boulders that are just like, you know, there'll be like six of them at this gym. And people like knowing that this is like a possibility and like a limit, like they're going to grow to like be able to achieve these things. But if your local gym only has boulders up to V10, then a lot of people get stuck in like the V7, V8 range. Like maybe occasionally they'll climb one of the V10s if it's softer, but they always kind of like, people always end up falling into, you know, like a few grades below the top of whatever their gym sets. But if that's just higher, everybody else moves up as well. And I think that would be really nice to see from like a route setting perspective. But having things like the tension board implemented into gyms definitely gives people access to like these really hard boulders that they can try and test themselves on, which is cool. Like anybody can go and try that 10,000 hours boulder and give their consensus on the grade. And same thing with the V15, it's listed as a project on the app. Anybody can light it up and give it a go, which I think is going to, like, having tools like that is just going to expand the strength of the climbing world drastically. You know, if people are able to see firsthand what the pinnacle is like at that point, they have a lot better idea of how to get there. And people will often be surprised that they're capable of doing these things with work that they might not have thought they were capable of in the past, which is pretty cool. So true.
100%. Love that. And you made a comment earlier about how sometimes watching World Cups, it's hard to understand what to be impressed by. And you said something about Sean doing some one arm stick to a crimp and swinging out. It's like, that's one of the fun things about boards. It's like, you want to know what that was like? Go try it. Like, go find out. Watch.
Yeah, go to your gym, light it up.
And then light it up and do it yourself. So I really like that. I think that's, got me all psyched. And just the last thing I'm going to say on boards, no big question here. I just wanted to take the moment to shout out Pusher and Jared Roth. And just, I know that you climb a lot. When you say spray wall, I have a hunch that what you mean is the Pusher spray wall. And just, I think you guys have a cool scene going on down there. And I really like Jared, and you know, that he's providing that for you guys. So just wanted to take a moment to say, go Jared, go Pusher.
Yeah. Jared's the man. He's been awesome for building that as like a resource for us to go into. He's like trying to grow Pusher, and it's been moving in like a really good way. And I think he's like, I really like what they're doing. Like shaping wise, is they're kind of like, he's always kind of like reshaping these old classics and kind of like reworking them in a way where they don't look out of place in like an average commercial gym scenario these days. But he's also been like doing a lot of work, creating like fiberglass holds and expanding like, you know, the more compy side of things too. But great work over there. Really cool guys. And that spray wall is all time. And he's been doing it. He's been really wanting to like give back and support a lot of like the top athletes, and the community doesn't quite have the funds to do it from Pusher. But this, building this wall, and like I got a key on me right now to go, and I can just go in and climb on that wall whenever I want. And that's kind of the way that he's been helping us out any way he can. And that's been like a huge resource, just having a nice big wall to go to and train on, full of like dope Pusher holds, and it just encapsulates like a lot of different styles, and it's cool. It's a really, really good board.
Dude, that's the highest honor. The key was bestowed upon you. And I know that crew that climbs there is just world class. So I'm always remembering those spray wall days with my buddies making up prompts. I just think that that is some of the most fun you can have climbing, is having a psych strong crew making up problems. And so, yeah, thank you, Jared, for providing that. So, all right, man, as we wrap up, I'm just going to throw this question to you that just putting you on the spot that I didn't prepare you for at all. I'm just going to take you back to the Southeast and just, I know it's a big place, but I'm going to ask you best single digit boulder and then best double digit boulder. And, you know, just so if anyone makes a trip down there, they might go, oh yeah, Zach told me to get on this one.
Man, that is so hard. There's so many good boulders and so many different styles that is really unique. And I'm sure once I give an answer, I'll think of a better one and regret my choice. But man, best single digit boulder.
Should we just put it?
It's got to be.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry, I interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I'm still.
Well, let's take you to an area that is most comfortable for you. Like, it, you know, was Chattanooga kind of like, you know, I guess the Stone Fort, or yeah, like what's the area that you are maybe most familiar with? So when you go and you're warming up, you're like, oh yeah, this one. Or if you were to recommend when they visit your home area, they got to try this one.
Yeah, I think like single digit boulder, I really like Spyro Gyros, like a V7 that's in like the main corridor. That thing has some really good rock and it's got a cool jump. And that thing is really nice. That one's got to be near the top of my list. That's always something I get back on. There's a lot of really good like V7 dinos there. Like Castaway is another one of those that's super pure. Have like perfect start rail, a foot, and just dunk a jug. So those are two that really stand out on the single digit range. And then in Chattanooga, a really underrated boulder. It's actually on the same mountain as LRC, but not in Stone Fort proper. It's Half Moon is like one of my favorite double digit boulders I've ever done. It's got like, it's this crazy long roof. It's about V14. It has like very few ascents. It doesn't get very much attention. I think the access might be a little weird these days. Man, that is an all time boulder. It starts all the way at the base of the roof in this perfect jug. You just climb these like consistent edges. You get worked up into these big Wacos in the roof, and it kind of just encapsulates, like, has like a lot of different styles. And I think that like building your base and climbing in the South, like kind of prepares you for like all of the individual like cruxes on that boulder. And it kind of like encapsulates all of them really well in this one super mega aesthetic, proud hard line. And that one really stands out to me.
Oh, that's so cool when you have these climbs that seem to somehow just showcase mastery of that area. You're like, okay, like if you can do this one, you've definitely put in your time here, you get it. So I hope you can find a video of that we can share. And if there's access issues though, bummer. But all right.
Yeah.
those are good. I know Castaway. I think I know Spyro Gyro, but I definitely know Castaway and think it's super pure and cool. So did you prepare a pro tip for us today, Zach? You got one?
Yeah, I have like a little loose one I kind of thought of last night talking to my roommate Odin. And I think that it is, if you want to climb hard boulders, you just, the only prerequisite is to try the hardest boulders. And I think that that's really, I think that a lot of people aren't, like, don't know or don't have the confidence within themselves to go out and like try these things that seem to be way above their limit, but you never know without trying if it's something that's going to suit you really well. And, you know, if you have like the general baseline strength to like get yourself off the ground and like attempt the moves, then you're strong enough in order to like get closer and get closer and get closer. And as long as you're strong enough to make progress on something, you're inevitably going to be strong enough to do it in the end. And I think that that's kind of been more and more apparent in the past couple of years of me like looking at the people who are ascending the hardest and looking at the people who aren't ascending as hard. And the only difference is the people that are ascending harder are trying the harder boulders and really putting in that work. So I think just knowing that you're capable of these harder things is, and having the confidence to go out there and try them is like such an overlooked prerequisite to sending hard. And, I think that's my pro tip.
No, it's really good. And I just want to add one thing to it where it's not just about showing up and, you know, putting down your pads. It's about actually trying it, or like, you know, like putting in the effort to see what you're capable of. I think that that's an underrated thing of showing up and giving it your best and being open to it being hard. And I like what you said earlier about projects kind of taking off some of the pressure. And I think that showcases that mindset you're just referring to there of showing up, doing your best, and then just being okay with whatever happens and then looking for progress, you know, keep on showing up.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. If you're able, I guess a better point within that is if you're able to get really psyched on the progression of trying something, you're going to be in a lot better place than going into a boulder with like an expectation of sending. But if you're like always just striving to climb a little bit better on something and finding a new body position that makes a move a little bit easier, if that gets you really psyched, then that's what it takes for you to be able to climb the hardest stuff. If you're always enjoying the process and always enjoying these like little minute, like even not even doing a new move, but doing a move that you've already done better is going to just open up and unlock the potential for you to do the next move even better. And getting psyched on these baby steps and this little progression is the biggest key to sending the harder rigs.
Yeah, Zach, it's really interesting to me because you said this earlier where you like to sink your teeth into a hard climb. Like you like finding something and pouring your efforts into it. When you're talking about Doors of Perception or Grand Illusion, you're talking about, you know, a dozen sessions or more. And it just is really interesting to me because it's kind of contrasted with comp climbing where it's literally 4 minutes. You know, it's not even a full session, right? It's just, here you go. And I just find it interesting that you can enjoy these very different modes of climbing. They're very different. And I think it's cool. It just shows your love of it deeply.
Yeah, I love all parts of it. I can get psyched on about anything that has to do with climbing.
Well, that's what it takes. on that note, any media that you have coming up to plug? I that's always a part of hard climbing is showing it off too. And I know that you've got some cool footage of some cool climbs and just wonder if anything's come down the pipeline that we can share here.
Yeah, definitely. I got, I've been working on this video project with my homie Brian for a while now. And, it's been really cool to like reconnect and make a new video with him. Cause we used to make a bunch of stuff back in the day. We had like this series called Wild Boys that we used to do in the South. And that was like right when he got into like his early stages of video creation and stuff. And since then he's leveled up on the gear side and just knowledge wise, he's become a lot more, dialed and like really impressive filmmaker. So I've been working on a project with him that's probably going to be, we're planning on releasing end of January, and that'll be out on Mellow. I think it's going to be called the Gala Tapes. It's just like kind of archival footage of a bunch of stuff that I've done over the past couple of seasons. And then yeah, after that I got I'm always out whenever I'm climbing. I'm always out filming if it's around that time where I think I might be able to do something cool. But yeah, we got the video pitched for me to go back down to Bishop and climb on some projects I got down there, and that's also going to be really cool. And that'll probably be probably by the time that's all filmed and done and released will be the end of or middle of next year. So next year expect a lot more video content coming from my way. I definitely want to, since as I'm focusing on climbing outside, I also want to be like focusing on that side as well. Cause I really do enjoy content creation and giving back, get people psyched in that way too.
Dude, content creation from pro climbers on videos is underrated. I don't think people realize how impactful it is. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It literally has caused me to travel around the world. Like one good picture, one sweet video. It's just like that thing where I will light up 10,000 hours on the tension board when I go to see what it's like. And when I see you on something really cool in the South, when I see that video of Half Moon, it makes me want to go and find out what it's really like. So please keep on sharing. I love watching your style of climbing. Maybe it's like, it's probably because I just want to be stronger like you. Although now we talked about all the technique and the, you know, all that subtlety. But I still know you as just physically being one of the most impressive climbers. And that always is cool to watch. So love your style. Love that you're putting out content. And I love that you came on here and shared all about it. Dude, I almost forgot. Yeah. Confluence was an incredible video. Like, I want to plug that for you again. I think that was with Bobby, nice. Put that one together, but incredible video. Yeah, we did a podcast on a review of it. So, and that's kind of old news now. It's long ago, but that was a cool video that you were, well, you had the title of the film with the FA you did. So, didn't want to forget that.
Yeah, no, that was an awesome process working on that one. I'm really hyped how it came together. And I think if you enjoyed Confluence, you're going to enjoy a lot of the content that I have coming this year. It'll be in like a very similar like skate style with like personal people's video parts, you know, and everybody's kind of battling together for like get the ender of the video. So kind of cool stuff like that. This one coming out will it'll have some guest appearances, but just me climbing in the video, but expect another video in that style. So
I'm looking forward to it. And thanks for really giving us that behind the scenes on comp climbing. I think I told you last time, I just had never, I've met a lot of comp climbers. I've done some competition climbing, but just those nuances of what the setting is really like, why it is the way it is, you know, what can be fun about it, what can be not so fun, and where they're heading. It just, I don't know. I just appreciate you shining a light on an area that it rarely is done in such detail. And so, yeah, thanks for sharing that. And I love that you're doing that and crushing it outdoors, making skate type climbing videos. It's just, you span the whole gamut of fun to be had out there. So thanks, Zach.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll have you on again when some of those amazing projects go down, and we'll do it alongside the video that comes out in 2024. It's coming up.
Hell yeah, I'm looking forward to it. That'll be awesome.
All right, take care and good. Have a safe trip and have a blast in Red Rocks. And Tim, we missed you. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more about Test Piece Climbing, you can check us out at testpiececlimbing.com and even book a session with one of our coaches.